This week's sermon is based on chapters 14 to 17 of Brian McLaren's book, Do I Stay Christian? I'm choosing to spend a bit more time on chapters 14 and 15, less on 16 and 17, which are about the cult of innocence of Christianity. And I generally think progressive churches are less susceptible to this and perhaps are well aware and honest about human moral failings that accompany us all, and that Christianity does not confer innocence on us. In fact, one of our progressive blind spots is when we believe we need to be justified by our works. If social action comes from a place of judgment, that is a belief that it confers moral superiority, then social action too, like innocence, can become an addiction instead of a place of integrity. But that will need to wait for another sermon. The conversation we heard in the Gospel of John between Jesus and a Samaritan woman is the longest conversation Jesus has with anyone in the Christian Testament. It bears looking at a little closer. This is, in many ways, an unremarkable story. No demons being driven out of pigs, no physical healing, no wise parables are shared. In the end of chapter 3, just before our story in chapter 4, we learn that a dispute arises between a Jew and John the Baptist about purification. And in the first verses of chapter 4, it's revealed that Jesus is making more disciples than John, as if this worldly competition might be significant. So the tension is mounting. Jesus is doing things that are raising eyebrows and acting in ways one would not expect within his Jewish community. A stranger, a Jewish man, shows up at Jacob's well at the base of Mount Gerizim, the place of Samaritan worship. This Jewish man has ventured into a foreign land. A woman from the community is there by herself at noon to draw water, possibly because she was ostracized within her community, possibly because of her history of relationships with men, which some might label a checkered history. It may be easier for her to come alone at noon in order to avoid the other Samaritan women. I delight in imagining Jesus, the wordsmith, the healer, the compassionate one, in this conversation. I delight in the tension present in real life. A man and a woman, a Jew and a Samaritan, playing with truth and metaphor about their identities. And the Samaritan woman is sharp. She is on to him. She reminds us in the story what we might have forgotten, that this meeting breaks the Jewish purity code, where a male Jew should not be speaking to a woman, let alone without other company, let alone asking for a drink. He is unclean for being there and for asking to use her dipper to get water. In their conversation, unlike Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus in the story last week, who doesn't understand Jesus' metaphor of being born again, the Samaritan woman in this story grows in her understanding of who Jesus is. In this story, the Samaritan woman persists in trying to figure out Jesus' purpose. Why is he there? And we might ask, why does Jesus persist in this conversation? Why doesn't he care about the purity code and skedaddle? But something remarkable does happen. Jesus doesn't flee, he stays. He is perceptive but not punitive about her past. Jesus understands her, and it seems to me that she experiences a kind of freedom that is extraordinary to her. Jesus accepts her with warmth and care as if they had known each other all their lives, and she calls him a prophet. In verses 21 to 38, she falls just short of what we call a Christological confession, saying, "I know the Messiah is coming, who is called the Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us." Jesus says, "I am he that is speaking to you." There are only a handful of such confessions in the Christian Testament, so this is a very interesting and important story. We learn that the New Age Jesus was bringing sets the stage to break down other barriers of gender and religion and culture. The New Age Jesus was bringing upended the idea that our worship is tethered to a certain place, Jerusalem or Mount Gerizim. Remarkably, the Samaritan woman is really the first evangelist in the gospel as she goes from her conversation with Jesus and tells her community of this remarkable man. In chapter 15, McLaren lifts up the dangers of reading the Bible literally and makes a case for not literal truth, but literary truth, metaphorical truth. He says that biblical language gives us stories as literary artifacts. Like a good scholar, he traces the roots of Bible stories to their source in an attempt to understand how stories are transmitted and how they evolve in this transmission. McLaren lays out a scenario. When people experienced Jesus, something extraordinary happened. We don't know in every case what it actually was, but it was out of the ordinary. Jesus was so extraordinary as to become legendary. How do people who have not met Jesus hear about him? Well, those who witnessed or experienced him told others. Oral tradition is how the Jesus stories and Jesus sayings spread throughout the land. It was an organic process. The disciples and those who experienced healing and those who had remarkable encounters with Jesus told others. The Samaritan woman went back to her thirsty community and offered them a drink too. As travelers traveled and retold the stories, memory and imagination contributed to the stories changing, becoming probably more vivid. The storytellers edited out the less ironic parts to make a better tale. Over time, differing versions of the story spread. People had to decide which versions to retell. Some communities might have heard two versions of the same story and merged them together, or chose which one was authoritative for them, depending on their feelings about the hero, the legend, the one bringing this new reality to the world. I submit that humans love words because they are our tools for conveying reality. Our words can bring to mind realities we may not have experienced yet. Jesus' extraordinariness is further embellished. Then at least one or more of the stories is written down, and for the most part, the stories become frozen from further embellishment, but not always, because there were copying errors and intentional changes to manuscripts. Humans love language. Language is a palette of colors, alliteration, onomatopoeia, homonyms, antonyms, sounds for meaning, pleasure, and imagination. It is a palette for painting stories that are cautionary, fanciful, ironic, instructional. Some stories simply share facts, and others are full of metaphor. McLaren illustrates the plausibility that stories were organically embellished in the Christian Testament by comparing the story of the exorcism of the demoniac and the suicide of the pigs as told similarly but differently in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And he addresses the differences between how humans used language and thought in the first axial age, of how many of us think and use language in the first century CE, lifting up the possibility that, yes, the demons are real, but we would call them something else today: mental illness in its many guises, bipolar, schizophrenia, depression, etc. Or perhaps the man with the demon had experienced sexual, physical, or emotional trauma that induced a breakdown, that in some way rendered him subhuman in the eyes of others. McLaren asks, in this world, the very same world we inhabit, couldn't kindness and love appear as a gift from God in Jesus, capable of driving out shame, unworthiness, aloneness, and melt the disdain and hatred of the populace? And McLaren lifts up another beautiful, maybe the most beautiful way of using language. It's so powerful, it can bring down systems of domination. It is so powerful, those subjected to domination, to cruelty at its worst, to torture, to unspeakable evil, can sometimes survive with their dignity intact because of the power of language. His examples. Enslaved people in the American South couldn't say blacks and whites are equal, slavery is evil, and slavery must one day fall, or they would be subject to physical abuse, torture, or even killed. Nor could a young woman in a strict patriarchal culture say, I'm fully equal to a man, or she would likely be shunned as unmarriageable and or banished from her family. Literal truth would be dangerous for these people to speak. But instead of giving up their dignity and strength by submitting to the domination system, to those imprisoning them, many people experienced oppression, who experience oppression, choose to speak and write in indirect communication. These folks speak literary truth, replete with metaphor and symbolism. And stories about Jesus often have something else, a twist of healing for the one scapegoated, yes, and those doing the scapegoating. Those who had kept the man at the edge of town without shelter and chains were healed of their simple understanding, their failure to understand what the man was suffering from. The village was healed too. So all of our literary devices, metaphor, simile, etc., can bear some kind of literary truth. And when literary truth conveys truth with a capital T from a person who heals as no one has healed before in their experience, whose teaching about love has full integrity with the way he's living, the story becomes a sacred story. Why choose to stay Christian? McLaren asks, because it would be a shame to leave Christianity in its infancy. In chapter 14, we receive a beautiful description of the history of the universe, all 13.7 billion years of it. I remember when I was learning about the different ages of the Earth history, when life emerged, evolution, etc., I took a 15-foot roll of paper and did the math to separate the sections into billions of years, down to millions, and there were humans in the last sliver of an inch of the 15-foot roll. McLaren takes us through 13.7 billion years and arrives at bipedal hominids, as evidenced by the skeleton we call Lucy, at about 3.2 million years old. Homo sapiens, that is modern humans, do not emerge until 200,000 years ago. So we've just jumped from Lucy at 3.2 million to 200,000, and humans probably invented language about 50,000 years later, at 150,000 years, and religion emerged alongside the agricultural revolution at about 10,000 years ago. If you missed my sermon in the fall about how fermentation might have been part of this emergence of religion, you can look it up, September 4th. Humans didn't figure out how to record their language, that is right, until about 5,500 years ago. At 2,000 years old, Christianity and human evolution by universe standards are in their infancy. In the first axial age, which is considered to be roughly 800 before the Common Era to about 200 of the Common Era, and I quote an authority on the subject named Jaspers, the spiritual foundations of humanity were laid simultaneously and independently in China, India, Persia, Judea, and Greece. In this time, early and great philosophical and religious foundations were laid. And during this time, Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Confucianism, Taoism, and yes, the Hebrew prophets and Jesus all emerged. There is a shift from humans focusing on survival and local concerns to pondering transcendence. Humans began speculating about our relationship to the cosmos and entertained the purpose of our lives. The second axial age, of which we are a part, is marked by technology. The second axial age began in the late 15th century, the Renaissance, and extends until now. First, it's marked by a quest to understand the interrelationship of all that is evolving. In McLaren's words, our discoveries are existential, that the earliest form of something is not its pure or original or best or permanent or ideal form. In fact, there's no really pure, original, best, or ideal forms. Every form is in process, adapting, evolving, mutating, and changing. Second, that the universe becomes more complex, more interdependent, more conscious. We could even say more beautiful and good, because now humans are part of it. And third, that extinction happens on the path of evolution. Because of our human power to create unsustainable imbalances in nature, that is, more carbon dioxide and consequently more heat in the atmosphere than our life on our fragile Earth can in its current life form sustain, we wake up each day, he says, in the 21st century with a choice to choose the path of evolution or extinction. One can become depressed quickly when one realizes the enormity of the consequence of our actions, that we could wipe out life as we know it on Earth that has evolved for these 3.7 billion years. And so I want to lift up a book I find extremely compelling. It's titled Saving Us by climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe. It's full of facts and reports and her experiences talking to thousands of people in hundreds of different venues, but more importantly, it is full of solutions. You may be surprised to learn that the single most important thing you can do to combat climate change is talk about it to everyone. And another fun fact, she's married to an evangelical pastor and lives in Texas. McLaren concludes in one of my favorite sentences in the book that Christianity is in its infancy, and what is needed is to help this fledgling religion learn to stop biting its playmates and feed itself. I understand why McLaren spends two chapters on the topic of innocence in Christianity, because the phrase he adopted from Nadia Boltz-Weber, The Cult of Innocence, can lead to a belief in superiority, supremacy, dominance. The cult of innocence disables some Christians from accepting and loving other Christians and people of other religions. The antidote, he says, is solidarity with all people. I'm just going to lift up a few highlights from these chapters. McLaren asks us to consider this bumper sticker. Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven. Sort of a regular, run-of-the-mill Christian bumper sticker, but imagine this bumper sticker on the back of an enslaver's carriage. This last section of the sermon is about conversion. Brian McLaren names a point in his own conversion away from one kind of Christianity and toward another when he realized, I don't want to win in a way that makes others lose. I'm guessing all of us have shifted any number of times from the Christianity we do not want to live into to the Christianity that beckons us into the future. McLaren presents four ways for us to move into the future. One, there's no way. Humanity is doomed. Two, there is one way, and Christianity or some other single religion or ideology is it. Three, there is one way, and it's the rejection of all religion. Or four, there may be a way to draw the best resources we can from all of our traditions. Not to cure us of being human, but to help us become more humane. Because in the end, we humans are all connected, woven, as Dr. King said, in an inescapable web of mutuality. I'd like to take 5 minutes or so and invite your participation into this sermon. I invite you to think of a time when you came to have clarity about what you don't believe, what you believe, or came to leave open the possibility of not knowing, not having an answer. Everyone, their beliefs and doubts and questions are welcome. This kind of self-clarity is really helpful, not only to ourselves, but to others. I was in My several years of training in nonviolent communication, I was sitting in a group and expressed my relief in my own journey as a Christian when I discovered that the idea of original sin was developed in Christianity by Augustine and was not central to Jesus' life or teaching, something I could explore in its mythic context in Genesis, but did not need to take a test on it or believe it. My Jewish friend Jared told me what a relief it was for him to hear this because he understood I was doing my own thinking about myth and doctrine. It was safer for him knowing I was not scapegoating Jews either. I had never been a literalist or a fundamentalist, but he didn't know that. It was important for me to say it. It's important to tell other Christians what kind of Christians we are. We are in the third week of Lent. As we approach the time when we tell the stories of the Last Supper and crucifixion, we can connect the story of the Samaritan woman to the crucifixion. In the words of Richard Lisher, professor emeritus at Duke University, with near unbearable irony, the keeper of living waters will say to Roman and Jewish spectators, "I thirst." But once he is dead and pierced, out will flow blood and water. Amen.